Okay, well, welcome everyone. And this is probably going to be our last session on the Book of Acts, although it doesn't mean you can't bring some contributions from there if you're still reading it and think of something interesting to add into it in next week or the week after. So what I'm going to do is I've got a couple of main topics, but a couple of smaller ones. But at least equally, if you've got something that you want to share, something that popped up in your reading of it, or something you've learned or thought about, then do indicate, because we'll do that as soon as possible. But if not, I'm going to throw at you a couple of sort of issues which have sort of been thrown my way from different people anyway, and so we'll chew it over together and it might be able to help me on this. So we're going back into Acts 15 to start with. I think was the chapter, main chapter we looked at last time. And in particular, it's the four rules, if you like, that came out of that, that was put in the letter and sent off back to Antioch. And the comment was, how does that square up with 1 Corinthians 8, where Paul talks about food sacrificed to idols? And he seems to suggest that it's sort of okay now, or at least in that context. So was Paul not aware of this particular ruling, or did he decide at that point it could be amended in some way? So that's the challenge before us. So I went back to look at both passages carefully. And I don't know if this sort of answers the question, but as I go through it again, I'm going to suggest that really there's two very different problems here being tackled, and therefore there's two very different solutions. But the question might still arise, do these two solutions in some way clash with each other? But the significance of the Acts 15 situation, which makes it very, very serious, is it seems to me that this is primarily about salvation and the role of circumcision within that, because these men from Judea coming down to Antioch, where the Gentile believers were saying, unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. And in verse 5, same people are saying, the Gentiles must be circumcised and required to obey the law of Moses. So that's the main issue behind all this. And of course, the main result of this, as Peter makes very clear, is verse 11, we believe that it's through the grace of our Lord Jesus that we are saved just as they are. It's by grace. So that's cleared all that up. Paul and Barnabas agree. James also comes to that same decision, makes his judgment, and then says, rather make things difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. In other words, that's the salvation bit again. They are turning to God. We mustn't put anything in their way to stop them coming to faith and receiving the grace of the new covenant. But we should write to them, telling them to do these four things, one of which is abstain from food polluted by idols or given to idols, and so on. And I also noticed just before we go on from there that basically in verse 21, it's Moses has been preached in every city and is still read in the synagogues every Sabbath. So we're not undermining what Moses actually taught. But these four particular things were put in the letter and sent off to Antioch, where they were well received. And I think one of the things we said before was that this is about making sure that Jew and Gentile can effectively get on well together, and can have fellowship and can have hospitality with each other at that sort of level. So it's a level down from salvation. It's how to sort of make sure that they don't end up in two different factions. So I think that's fairly clear from there. 1 Corinthians 8, if you need to glance at that again, Paul now is dealing with a situation just purely within Gentiles, not between Jews and Gentiles, but within Gentiles, and it's the issue between what he seems to call the stronger and the weaker ones, or a matter of conscience now. And he's answering something that they have said. Because when he says in verse 1 of chapter 8, now about this, he's doing exactly the same as the beginning of chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, which is now for the matters you wrote about. So now he's going to address what they've written to him about. And that's why back in chapter 7, that first verse, Paul is not saying it is good for a man not to marry. He's quoting what they have said to him or written to him. Okay, now for the matters you wrote about, here's the first one. This is what you've said. And now he's going to comment upon it. So that's a good example of how not to just quote something and say, well, Paul said this. Actually, he was commenting upon what they had said. So in chapter 8, they've come up with another issue that he's going to address. And it seems that what they say is that we all possess knowledge. And Paul's general point to start off on this is, okay, but it's love that is more important than knowledge. It's love that builds up. Knowledge simply puffs people up, makes you proud. Love is what makes you humble and builds you up, because you need to treat people properly. So that's the issue here. And again, it's not salvation. It's about fellowship between brothers. And if I've understood correctly from verse 4 onwards, the business then, the particular issue of eating food sacrificed to idols, Paul is saying, effectively, an idol is nothing at all. So we should know that. But he says in verse 7, not everyone knows that. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol. In other words, they think there's something really sort of in it from that point of view. And that's a situation that's very sort of strange and still very sort of archaic to us, because although we could say, well, what's our idols today, we don't quite have it in that same sort of way. And it may well be that we discern our idols differently, one brother from another. So he's then going on to talk about make sure that you don't offend a brother. You don't make him sin. You don't even destroy him. It's very strong words that he uses, by your particular attitude towards him on this particular issue. So I see them as perhaps a slight overlap with the 1 Corinthians 15, but I don't see that Paul is suddenly going against what was written in that letter and what the early church decided was important at that point in Antioch. But any thoughts from you on that? Do you still struggle with this thing between 1 Corinthians 8 and the original Acts 15? Gary?
Do you think Romans 14 also speaks clearly into this?
Yeah, it's the same issue, isn't it? But
there they mention about don't destroy the faith of a weak brother for the sake of food. So that could link up with the Acts 15, couldn't it?
Yes, it is. And I don't think there's a real clash there. I think it is being discerning in each situation and making sure that your so-called knowledge of things, your desire to appear smarter and clever and so on, doesn't destroy the faith of someone who is apparently sort of weaker. Alison?
I think for me, it also highlights very much that when you're reading Paul, you have to look at the context and who he's writing to.
Yeah.
That he's not writing one distinct thesis for everybody.
Yeah.
Basically, there are actually three people he writes to. There's the Gentiles, the Jews, and a hypothetical other. Just have to kind of look at that. I think that was the thing that I came to in this verse in Ephesians that our vicar was talking about. That talking to the Gentiles, he was saying, you are coming into a citizenship. But he wasn't kind of then putting aside, as we know from Romans 11, he wasn't putting the Jewish people aside from their promises. So it's really important to know.
Yeah. And the common principle that comes through all the time is love is more important than some of these other issues, given that they're not the main ones of salvation. So we're not sort of distorting real truth and that. We're just looking at how to help people to build each other up in love and faith and so on, and not trip each other up. So I think I'm happy in my own mind on that. Any other comments on that, or shall I give you the second one? The second one is in Acts 16, where Paul actually circumcises Timothy. So this will be, I think it's at the beginning of the chapter. So Acts 16, it's verse 3, where it says, Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek, was Gentile. And the question that's been put to me is, Paul actually criticizes Peter for doing this sort of thing and so on. Is he, by circumcising Timothy here, taking a bit of a liberty himself when he should actually be a bit more consistent with his own advice to other people? So trying to look at the context of Acts 16, first thing I noticed, yes, okay, his father was Gentile, but his mother was Jewish. So there must be a case, therefore, for allowing him to be circumcised anyway. Begs the question of why he wasn't circumcised in the first place. But was he doing it just for what might call it social, cultural sort of reasons, to make sure that that Timothy was more accepted as he goes along on the journey? In other words, it wasn't really a covenant thing. He wasn't circumcising him in the sense of, okay, he's taking him back into the Mosaic covenant. Were there other reasons? So do you think Paul is being consistent there, or being wise, or being inconsistent, or being wise, whichever way around look at it? Malcolm?
Isn't in Jewish normality that the being a Jew comes through the mother?
Well, it is now. I think that's something, as far as I can tell, that came in more, I won't say exactly when, I'll just hedge my bets and say medieval times. I don't think that was necessarily the case in biblical times, if I understood correctly. The reason for it being needed later was, in biblical times, it was always clear who both the father and the mother were. As morals got a bit more lax, it wasn't always clear who the father was, but it was always clear who the mother was. So you could guarantee, okay, the mother is Jewish, but the father, not always clear who it was, then that might cause a different issue. Dave, can you unmute? Thank you. And then John afterwards, please.
I was just about to say the same thing about Malcolm, that mother was Jew, and the religious part of it comes from the mother. So that's why he was circumcised.
Well,
just going into the church as well to preach, then he should be living up to their customs.
Yes. And I suppose Paul just playing safe, therefore, he wasn't treating it as a big sort of issue, not like in Acts 15, where, you know, you must be circumcised in order to be saved. He's doing it for another reason. So that's okay, I imagine. John Rogers.
The question about being Jewish, I think it's a fairly recent thing about the law of return. But I was speaking to, there was a Jewish guy, in actual fact, that said, oh, shouldn't take any notice of these old rabbis that pass out these laws as they feel like it. And that's a comment I have to make and pass on to you.
Thank you. So I want to avoid the charge here that the apostles were inconsistent, or it was all very cultural. And therefore, when we think what we get out of the book of Acts, we might think, oh, well, it doesn't really apply. We don't need to worry about that now. I mean, when it comes to the food and idols and so on, and we perhaps talked about this a bit last week, the question that comes to my mind is, what if I think something is an idol, but you don't? And therefore, I don't do something because I think it's an idol, but you do. How do I treat you then? And then obviously, how does a teacher teach to that situation? So let's just suppose, not particularly pick on anybody or offend anybody here, but I like sport. For some people, sport could well be an idol. For others, it's not an idol. You can enjoy it without it being an idol. So therefore, we can't doing sort of carte blanche teaching to everybody on that sort of thing. But I suppose if you spot that something is becoming an idol to someone, then perhaps you have to sort of step in a little bit. But sometimes the pastor has a harder job than the teacher on sorting that sort of thing out. Any final comments or snippets on anything really in Acts before we go to one of our two main studies? Okay, well, I hinted last time that we're going to look at, John.
Yes, me. It was just a wandering thought. How did anybody actually know whether someone was circumcised or not?
Yeah.
Everybody expected to be strictly honest in their reply.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. Answer that one. Thank you for that. Okay. If anyone else wants to tell me on that one, we've got Gary next, and then I think it's Alison. So,
well, to answer the circumcision, I think if they go to the mikveh.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. As we know, they didn't go to the gymnasium and do their athletics and so on in the new. But so, okay. Yeah, I suppose it would eventually come. Or maybe it's just they would be asked generally, and you don't want to lie about it, do you? So,
no, but they would.
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Say it again, Alison.
They would know at the mikveh.
Yeah, at the mikveh, yeah. That's a good point. Let's have Gary next and then Rose.
Yeah, you mentioned last week, Paul, about looking up chronology of Acts. And you mentioned things like chronology and you mentioned charts.
Yeah.
So I found, to my rating so far, an amazing chart.
Okay, that's the second one of my items.
Okay.
I'm going back down about half an hour or so. Do you mind just holding that? Because what I'm going to do, the second one, we're going to look at the missionary journeys and try and put those in a sort of chronological thing and tie things together a little bit like that. But thanks for that. We'll come back to you. Rose?
You may have made this clearer in a previous teaching, but in the first century, certainly, immersion, the mikveh was completely a self-done thing.
Yeah.
And the immerser was somebody who observed from above, but it was done completely naked. And the immerser had to see that, you know, that the water got between your fingers and that your hair went under the water. And
yeah.
So certainly the immerser would know.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'll go and answer now to that awkward question. Thank you. So last time I said we're going to look at a particular character, but not one of the main ones, because within the book of Acts, as I said, there's 88 named people, and there's obviously the great missionaries, the great apostles, and so on. There's others that are simple servants, some just followers of Jesus that get a brief mention. And I want to pick out one of them to see what we can learn from him. And that person is Agabus. Agabus. Who knows where to find Agabus in the book of Acts? Give you a clue, there's two places you'll find Agabus. Anyone found one of them yet? Perhaps you know more what he did than where to find him, but actually the sort of timing of it is quite critical. Anyone found any of them yet? Okay, well, one is towards the end of chapter 11. We'll start with that one. So he appears twice, quite some time apart. So if you found at the end of chapter 11 from verse 27, you've got some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. Okay, and one of them, Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. And then we're told that this actually happened during the reign of Claudius. And what's obviously interesting about this is the disciples then decided to act upon that. And we're going to think as a sort of follow-up to looking at this guy, what did they do? Of course, they sent their gift to the elders through Barnabas and Saul. So there was a money issue cropping up. So firstly, that was a prophecy that came through Agabus that there would be a severe famine, and it was spread throughout the Roman world. And obviously he was believed because they decided to act upon it. Okay, so we'll look at the consequences of that in a minute. So the believers in Antioch basically sent help down to the believers in Judea, and particularly Jerusalem. And he appears again in Acts 21. Perhaps when we come back to our chronology, we might think how far apart that is. But obviously a lot has happened between chapter 11 and chapter 21. And he's there in verses 10 and 11. And I think we're fairly sure it's the same guy. It's not the sort of name that would appear, I think, two different people. And this time he's somewhere else. He's come down from Judea. This time he's reached Caesarea. So he's actually, he travels somewhere to deliver his message, basically. And he comes from Judea and he meets the Apostle Paul on his way to Jerusalem. Again, we'll tie that in with Paul's journeying in a few minutes. And this is where he does a particular action coming over to us, because Luke's now involved in the story. So he records this guy came over to us. He took Paul's belt, tied his own hands and feet with it, and said, "The Holy Spirit says, in this way, the Jews of Jerusalem will bind the owner of this belt and hand him over to the Gentiles." So he has another very clear prophetic message, which in this case he acts out. In each case, therefore, he has faithfully delivered what God has given him. And in the first case, they said, okay, then we better collect some money. There's going to be a famine. In the second case, if it was meant to be a warning to Paul, and the follow-up is the people pleaded with Paul not to go, therefore, Paul says, no, I'm going. He would not be dissuaded. So we all gave up trying to persuade him not to go. And he said, the Lord's will be done. So we got ready and off we went. And of course, that prophecy also came true. If you know what happens after this, because once he's taken some money there, so another things happen, and he's arrested. And that's where he ends up in house arrest. And that's where we sort of leave him at the end of the book of Acts. And I guess some of us would think, well, come on, you were warned. Why do this? and what a waste. Because that means now he's not going to be able to do any more missionary work and so on. Surely he's messed up here. He got a word saying what would happen. And basically he ignored it and he went ahead anyway. So any comments upon either of those incidents or the guy himself, all the reactions to it? What are we learning from him and these two events, do you think? Anybody got anything to contribute? Yes, John.
Neither of the occasions is it recorded that they tested the prophecy.
Okay.
Accepted straight on that.
Yeah. I suppose, thank you, the point could be made that by the time he does the second one, he's got a sort of tried and tested track record, is what I'm trying to say. But even then, you should still weigh each particular one. Just going back to the first one, what did it say? Yeah, no, there's nothing, as you're quite right, there's nothing to actually say that they did. It just says he stood up and through the Spirit predicted. So they must have recognized it in some way. But yes, you're quite right, it's not specific. Rose?
I believe the Spirit had already made it clear to Paul that he would suffer.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah.
He's back, not the Christ.
Back in Acts 9, if you remember, well, actually, I think I said this at the time, but the Lord says to Ananias, go and lay your hands on him, because he's my chosen vessel to the Gentiles, and I must show him how much he will suffer. And basically, I don't think Paul is being disobedient here, because I don't think the Holy Spirit is saying to Paul, don't go. He's just saying, this is what's going to happen. This is what you can expect. So perhaps it's the other believers that are not acting in faith, and now trying to say, oh, no, don't go. And Paul says, well, actually, it's not God telling me not to go. It's just God warning me of something which I could well understand is going to happen anyway. So maybe he's preparing Paul through this message rather than trying to put him off. So, yes, Dave.
As far as I'm aware, most of the prophets were all in the Old Testament. And this is the only time I've heard of a prophet being mentioned in the New Testament. Most of them were all talking about the disciples and other books.
Yes, but there are other examples of prophets in the New Testament. I mean, earlier in Acts, it talks about Philip's four daughters being prophetesses, aren't it? And of course, in the letters, now you could argue to what extent is it like that sort of prophecy, because we're all meant to be prophets, we're all meant to be able to foretell things. So you don't always get many examples, but in the first one, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. So it wasn't just him. And when we think about, was it tested? Maybe it was tested amongst all the prophets. Maybe he said to the others, this is what I'm going to say. What do you think about this? So I don't think they were surprised that there was something like this happening. But perhaps there weren't that many really strong words that came often. Gary?
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul, that the prophecy from Agabus is about him being bound.
Yeah.
And it's further on when the people try to dissuade him from going. And he then repeats, I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die.
Yeah.
And I noticed in his arrest and trials, he never dodged the issue.
Yeah.
And I think going back to Acts 9, he was very clear, as somebody's already pointed out, show him what he must suffer for sake.
And he says, I'm ready to die in Jerusalem and for the name of the Lord Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's a good testimony because, of course, he didn't die in Jerusalem. He was arrested and he went off to Rome. So actually, there was still a long way to go on all this. I suppose what the other disciples were saying, basically, we don't want to, if you get arrested and so on, then what do we do? We need you. We rely on you. Well, actually, they probably had to learn what to do when Paul was in house arrest. God would want you to use them differently. Malcolm?
In terms of evangelism, the only difference was he continued, but he didn't have large crowds to evangelize.
Yes.
Or to individuals.
Exactly, he did. They came to him in the house and so on. So his ministry wasn't over. And in fact, he started to write more letters. So his ministry changed in that sense. So maybe his traveling days were over. But actually, just by going to Rome, he ended up still being an evangelist. It's just that now he wasn't free to go where he wanted. He had to sort of follow what God was doing. Alison, I think your hand is up.
Yes. So it's kind of not a philosophical question, but is there always just a plan A that God wants us to follow? Or does he sometimes allow us to make a choice? And actually, Paul could have gone either way and he wouldn't have been punished by God for going either way.
I see what you're saying.
He was put in that position and he had felt constrained by the Spirit, but God would have had work for him to do, whatever.
Yeah, okay. That's a good point, yeah.
People think, if you don't follow this way, then you're on plan B, but
does
God ever have a real plan B? Or is it that both are plan A and we...
Yeah, I know.
Decision for ourselves and be grown up about it.
You can argue sort of both ways on that, or it is a bit sort of philosophical, as you say. But I think Paul, he heard that particular word, he understood it, and he said that doesn't counter what I already know, and so on. The other thing I get from these is how bold Agabus must have been to say these, and so. You know, he must have been a tough character in that sense. And we may only got these two very short incidents, but no doubt he was used by God elsewhere that we don't know about. These are the ones that impact the story of the book of Acts, if you like. So that's why he's a character that comes on the stage briefly just twice, and yet he had a profound influence upon the whole thing. So let's talk about the second bit of this, which is the result of the famine, is that they decided to collect some money. The believers in Antioch began to gather money to send to the Christians living in Judea, and they sent the money by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. This monetary gift, I'm reading this obviously, this monetary gift was a fitting response, because in the ancient Roman Empire, there was usually still food available for purchase during a famine, but at dramatically elevated prices. So with adequate funds, the Christians in Judea were still able to purchase food and support their families as well. And the love gift from Antioch was all the more important as a sign of the unity between the Jewish Christians in Judea and the Gentiles in Antioch, a unity which Paul would obviously be very keen to promote. So there was something else about this, I think. That this collection, though, would be quite unique in the ancient world. The Greco-Roman world, it had a system of public benefaction, but not like modern fundraisers where people are solicited for money, which is then distributed to the poor. In Judaism, the poor received alms from individuals, but the money was not collected in mass for redistribution to the poor. And there's only one example in the whole of ancient literature of this sort of thing. So since Paul is collecting money within the Gentile world, this would have been very unusual, unprecedented almost, and potentially looked upon as suspicious. What's he going to do with this? Is he trustworthy? And so on. But he did include the representatives of the churches to give confidence that he was not going to run away with the funds. So the question is, where else do we read about this sort of thing? What verses are there? And it gets a little bit confusing, as though there might have been two occasions. But let's just have a look and see what we can find. I think in Acts 24, verse 17, there is a mention of this. Acts 24, 17, if it is indeed the same one. It says, after an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. Now, the question is that in response to Acts 11, which is probably a long time earlier, and there's no mention here of the famine. So this might well have been a second offering, another occasion in which he collected money for them. But that's the only other mention you get in Acts. Galatians chapter 2 also mentions something like this. Let me get there. This is about his visit to Jerusalem. I'm not sure it mentions money in this one, does it? Galatians 2, 14 years later, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. I wonder if that's the occasion of the Acts 24 verse. But now I look at it, I'm not sure that there's anything in that about specifically about money. But I think the main passage in the 1 Corinthians 16, there's two other passages worth looking at, but let's turn to 1 Corinthians 16. Because if I'm heading anywhere with this as a discussion point, it's, well, we all know that we're meant to be generous and we're meant to look after believers who are struggling and so on. And that may be something we need to think about increasingly in the current climate with, you know, higher prices for food and fuel and energy and so on. How do we do this? Somebody at 1 Corinthians 16, if Paul gives some idea about how he went about doing this. This is the collection for God's people. Okay, So whether this is a principle that ought to be applied elsewhere, you decide. But he says, now about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches to do. So in other words, it seems as though he had a common policy here on this. And he says, on the first day of every week, that to me says, this has got to be regular, okay? Each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. So what comes out of that is that when he turns up, he's not going to have a big whip round at that point. The money will already have been collected on a weekly basis according to ability to give, if you like, and money is set aside. He doesn't say you have to give it to the church. He doesn't say you have to put it in a particular collection box. And he certainly isn't advocating that it's done like a tithe. But it's as though in your own heart, every week you set something aside and it stays set aside so that when the need arises and he comes and says, now's the time to give, that's when it's there, it's ready. So they're meant to give, as I say, systematically, not in a haphazard now and again sort of thing, but individually. It's necessary to give, but it's a personal decision. And it's not just given away and then I wonder what will happen to it. It's set aside for a purpose and it's proportionate to income. In other words, how God has prospered you. And that was the collection for God's people. That's the principle that Paul seemed to put out there in order to say that's the one that will work in this particular case. Anyone want to comment upon that, Malcolm?
I was just going to ask, this is to speaking to Gentiles.
Yeah.
So what would have happened with them regarding tithing or not? Or would this be regarded as their tithe?
No, they wouldn't have tithed at all. Tithing was not taught to New Covenant believers. Whether they were taught, I mean, there are the passages on giving. Some of you might remember, like 2 Corinthians 8 and so on. So they might have had other opportunities to give. But again, I'm trying to make the point, it isn't like that they had to give to their own church because they had a pastor to support with a mortgage and they had a building to repair and a roof to keep, in good repair and so on. Actually, they were able to think about the poor and the needy and give to them because they didn't have all these other overheads, if you like, of running a church. But if you want to dig into what else Paul has to say about giving, you need the encouragement in 2 Corinthians 8 to give generously and so on. There's never any mention that you do it as in the Old Testament way, in the tithing way. And if you've heard me teach on tithing, you'll realise that it isn't 10%. The full tithe isn't 10%, because there's two tithes of 10% and there's another occasional one which makes your total bill around about 23, 24%. So if you're really keen on doing Old Testament tithing, make sure you give away about a quarter of your income. People don't like to hear that. but it's generosity and it's cheerfulness and it's giving according to the Spirit and so on. There's just one other verse while we're looking at this issue. It's in Romans 15. What's he say here about this? This might be the gift. So Romans 15, it's verse 23 onwards, and in fact it's verse 25 when he says, I'm journeying through, I'm on my way to Jerusalem in the service of the saints there, for Macedonia and Achaia were pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. But if the Gentiles have shared in the Jews' spiritual blessings, they owe it to the Jews to share with them their material blessings. So after I've completed this task here with you and completed this task of taking the money to them and made sure that they've received this fruit, then I'll go on to Spain and I'll visit you again. But basically, I'm planning to come to you, but I must do this first because they've given all this money generously. the saints in Jerusalem need it, and I've set this up, so I've got to fulfill this. I can't delay it any longer. Macedonia and Achaia, we'll find out exactly where they are in a few minutes when we look at these journeys. But again, I suppose that fits in with what he said to Corinth and what he said to the churches in Galatia, and no doubt everywhere else he went. Anyone want to comment on any of that? Okay. So the main point of all that was, don't ignore the little characters, because he had two important things to say, two important consequences of all this. And I suppose in both cases, it was preparing people for what was to come. In both cases, it involved something negative or bad, a famine and an arrest and so on. But God wanted his people to deal with it and so on. Gary?
I think it's quite interesting but Agabus giving this prophecy, warning Paul that there was difficult times ahead for him, he'll be bound. And then some of the people tried to put him off going. There's an interesting point for all of us, probably we've all got it, I hope so, that when prophecy is given that it's near to us, we need to be very careful that we don't test it from an emotional or a personal background. I remember when I was felt the call of God twice in a particular situation in my life, some people close to me opposed it.
Yeah.
So we have to be very careful.
I know. If we have our own sort of wishes and desires, and so if a prophecy chimes in with that, we say, yeah, great, I can test that, that's fine. But the whole point from the Old Testament sort of prophecies was, if someone going around saying peace, peace all the time, which obviously you want to hear, the chances are that's the false prophet. Any other thoughts on these little incidents? Okay, in which case then we'll move to the final thing, which is on the, back to the chronology a little bit, and then the sort of missionary journeys to fill in that bit of it. I showed you a chronology last time. I didn't actually pull it up again this, and I said, I wonder how accurate it is and so on. I've now realised where I got it from. I've got a huge chart, I think from the days when I used to, before we did things on Zoom and share screens, we used to go out and buy huge sort of wall charts. So I think I just copied it from that, apparently, perhaps a long time ago without thinking about it too much. Now, actually, I've been sent another one. I think it came from John, didn't it, Rose? Yeah, John kindly sent me a two-sided document, and I'm sure there's things in there that are similar, but as always, there's a year or two out in all this. Gary, you were going to say something about chronology, I think, when you said you got a chart.
Yes, I found a chart online, and I mean, it's 8 pages, but there's got a few maps about the missionary journeys of Paul.
Right.
There's a column with the date of the year.
Right.
Then there's a column with the church event. Then there's a column with where certain letters were written and when.
Yeah.
And then the third one is the Roman emperors who were in reigning at that time.
Right. Well,
but each section also is got little subheadings, which is a wonderful aid to someone who was going to study through the book of Acts.
Right. Are you going to tell us sort of how to find it for the people?
Yeah, shall I send on a link?
Yeah, or can you put it in the chat?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That'd be useful. But what we'll do, as I go through my one-page version, and I have got maps to show you, I'll keep pausing for you to come in with all these extra details, actually. So thank you. That solved my problem of how do I make this last 40 minutes? And I thought this is going to be about 10 minutes, but so it's great. We've got a, I've got an assistant teacher today for this. We'll wait till he's done the chat bit just to make sure that he's with us. I mean, we all know that Paul went on missionary journeys, and we probably think we know it fairly well. And I suppose if you went to Sunday school, you might have done this to the extent of boredom on it, you know, that sort of thing that school Sunday school teachers used to love to do anyway. But I hadn't looked at it for a while. So I'm going to try and take you through this. Are you getting anywhere with this link? It's coming. Right. OK. Thank you. So if you want to have a look at that, I'll give you a moment to write that down. Or copy it or whatever you want to do. I just wonder if you can Google it by just saying something like Acts Timeline or something. Anyway. Just,
if you press on it, it should open it, and it tells me my access is denied.
Ooh, oh, oh, are you? Okay. csmedia1.com. Is that because there's something missing, like some slashes or something, or because it really doesn't want you to be there?
I don't know.
Okay.
It really won't open it anymore.
Well, I found CS Media One. And then if I sort of go after that Acts timeline, I'm not pressing or copying that. I'm just trying to do it myself. It's coming with all sorts of other ones.
I've just tried it on my phone on Google, and it's opened the first time.
Ah, now Jeremy's come in with, is this pretty much the same one, do you think? Jeremy, oh. Tell us about this, Jeremy.
Well, I just Googled the link or the PDF that Gary had.
Okay. So that one might, if you want to try it, I'm happy to spend another minute while we try this, just rather than leave it. I'm sort of trying it myself now. See if I can copy. That's not what I wanted. A load of rubbish on us. Let's try again. Where are we? So I copied that link. I'm putting it in. Right. Okay. I've now got a wonderful 8 pages of it. So thank you. I will print that out afterwards and add it to my notes for another time. So they said I copied it and used it in Google, came up first time. Yeah, okay, great. So that will do. So there you are. You can do a follow-up study later. I'll, in my case, put it for a resource for another time. Thank you. Meanwhile, I think I'm going to try and share my screen now. What I actually have got is I've got all the maps twice because I thought one of them was really good, and then I realized it might be a bit too cluttered to make a lot of sense. So you'll see everything from me about twice. So the first missionary journey of Paul, and again, Gary, keep chipping in without me sort of having to ask you to. This is found in chapters 13 and 14. Okay, chapters 13 and 14 of Acts is the first time they go off. It's Paul and Barnabas, and they basically go to the Galatia area. Galatians isn't just one church, it's many churches within Galatia. And you can sort of see from that map, although it's a bit cluttered. So what I'm going to do is I'll move on to the simpler version. There it is. And I might then go back to it. So this takes you on the journey from, it always seems to start from Antioch in Syria. That's Syrian Antioch, not the other one. Syrian Antioch. And he will return there. And this is where he goes via Cyprus. These two places are mentioned, Salamis and Paphos, in chapters 13 and 14. And then on to Perga, in this place, Pamphylia, Now, this is where John Mark suddenly ups and goes. This is going to cause the problem later. But I think it says here that this is where John Mark abruptly leaves them. So Paul and Barnabas then go on to Antioch in Pisidia. Around these places, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. And then they reverse that bit, as you can see from this arrow, and it doesn't go on anywhere. So they reverse all the way back and eventually sail back to Antioch, but don't stop off for a holiday in Cyprus this time. So it was relatively short. I've got here that it's around about AD 47 to 49, a couple of years. I mean, it's not going to be a quick journey wherever you go then. In some of these places that happen here, there's Jewish resistance the time you get to Antioch in Pisidia. There's a plot to kill them in Iconium, but they're mistaken for gods in Lystra. And he gets stoned as well. But, you know, there we are, part of the course, if you're going to be a missionary. But just go back up to that one. It's just another version of it, but it tells you the same journey, and it adds a few details. Anything you want to add, Gary, then, on the first missionary journey?
I was going to say a side issue, but that's disgusting, really. It says in the chart, around about the same time, James writes his letter of James.
Right.
to link things in, you know, with the whole timeline.
Right. Okay. And does it still say it's around about 47 to... Because yes. Actually, I've got here also, it could be 45 to 47 or even 45 to 49. So,
yeah, it says about 47, 48.
Mm. Okay, because again, I've got this one that John and Rose sent me, which also has the letter of James around about 45. That's James, the brother of Jesus, not the James that's going to be martyred. And then Paul starts off. Yeah, okay, it's got many different lines. Now, it's after that, then, that you've got the Jerusalem Council, which I think we said last time that Paul and Barnabas contribute towards that on the basis of, well, we've already been around these Gentile churches and we've seen the Holy Spirit at work, so we know it's God, and we can add to that big debate that was going on there. So that's the first one. Anything else, Gary, or
are you on the second journey?
Not yet, just in case you've got more to add.
No. Okay.
Right. So the second one. So it looks like that on the big map, the more complicated one. Let's simplify it first of all. I've got it looking like that. This starts in Acts 15:36. After the conference, and therefore around AD 50, it's usually regarded as AD 50, and was going to last until about AD 53 or 54. And the impetus seems to be, let's revisit the previous places. So as we're going to see, that again, he will travel from Jerusalem, where they've been for the conference, go off to Antioch, because that's obviously sort of base, and is going to set off, this time without going to Cyprus, but will set off going around the same area as before in Galatia, which I'm getting this right. There we are. But of course, before that, there's this big dispute between Paul and Barnabas. Should we take John Mark? No, he abandoned us first time. Barnabas says, oh, I'll give him another chance. And Barnabas and Mark go off to Cyprus again to revisit those places. Because Mark, of course, John Mark had been to Cyprus on the first journey, he just ran away later, whatever reason. And Paul now takes Silas. So Silas becomes a major player at this point. And so they go through, there we are. So he will travel through these places again, overland this time to, I keep losing my cursor, I can't find it. Tarsus, Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, all the same places. And at Lystra, something important happens. Timothy joins him. And that was the bit we read about when he was going to be circumcised. So this is where we pick up Timothy at... So Timothy joins in here with them. Eventually he travels all the way over here. That's where, when they get, so he's now gone further than before. This is a major departure this time. And that's where he has the vision of the man of Macedonia who says, come over and help us. So now he goes into Europe, as we now know it, obviously, into Europe. And at Troas, another major thing happens. Luke joins the party. So both senses of the word, really. So Timothy has come into play. Luke now joins in from Troas. There's a short sea journey across into Europe, or basically Greece and so on. So Neapolis, which I think is the sort of port that goes with the place of Philippi. What happens at Philippi? You remember Lydia is mentioned there. She's part of that. Paul and Silas are imprisoned. But as a result of that, the Philippian jailer is converted. I think it's interesting that Luke doesn't say he was in prison. It's as though Paul and Silas get thrown into prison. Luke always seems to sort of avoid the major problems like this. He's just sort of recording it all, unless he just is too modest to say it happened to him as well. And they go round, but when eventually, obviously, they get out from there. Paul establishes churches there in Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. Berea get the mention that we all know about because the disciples in Berea checked everything out with the word of God and so on. Good principle for us. And then on to Athens and Corinth. So these are major places. In Corinth, he stays 18 months. Okay, so that's going to be a major place, more than Athens, really, Corinth. And then he goes to this place, Kenchrea, if that's how you pronounce it, Kenchrea, which is the port there, ready for a big sail back. Calling in at Ephesus, so now there's another new place. And then eventually going back to, well, actually, where does he go back to? He does go back to Antioch, but it seems as though he sails not directly there. He'll go back to Antioch eventually, but it looks so he sails back to Caesarea. So that's the other version of the same one where you can see just the extent of that journey. It's quite significant. I think it's probably good that, you know, God says, here, just do the first one, make it short, simple, get used to all the problems, and then I'm sending you further. And I dare say Paul didn't intend to go across the Aegean Sea or across to from Troas into Greece until he got the vision there. So he had to be prepared to be flexible and keep going. So what have you got for us, Gary, on all that? Fill us in with some more details.
Quite early in the journey, probably before he went very far from left Syria. He wrote his letter to the Galatians while he was at Antioch. At the same period of time, Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome.
Right, and isn't that how he meets up with Priscilla and Aquila? Is that, have we got the right people there?
Yes.
Yeah,
and then towards the end of the journey, while he's at Corinth, I think, yes, he writes First Thessalonians.
Yeah.
Soon followed by Second Thessalonians.
Yes, they're certainly early letters. Galatians is often regarded as the earliest one because he'd been in Galatia before, so it made sense of that. I mean, he shows how... How naive I was in the early days of all this sort of thing. I always assumed that, oh, he wrote 1 Thessalonians. Did he do it while he was in Thessalonica? No, of course he didn't. He wrote later. He wrote after he'd been there. He wrote back to them. They're not letters that he wrote while he was there. He'd moved on somewhere else. And it's interesting that he did write twice in succession. There's always a chance you wrote more times. It's just that they weren't preserved and put in our Bibles. We got the letters that God wanted us to have. Any other details in all that?
No, that's about it for there.
Okay. Malcolm, you had your hand up. You still have. Yeah, Malcolm.
Yeah, just interesting that he went from Berea to Athens by sea when there's a land link all the way.
Yeah, that's a good point. As you say, on both of those maps. Yes, he did, didn't he? Yes. Yeah, thank you. That just got my notice. Any other thoughts or comments on that? Anything?
Well, there's something in the way.
Sorry, I can't do it. In the way. Sorry, I can't hear who that is because you're not on my screen anymore. Can you?
Oh, it's Alison.
Okay.
There are mountains in the way.
Oh, okay.
In the way for a start.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was Mount Olympus in the way, I can see on this map.
Yeah, that's right.
Mount Olympus. So, okay. Yeah, it may have been the quickest and easiest way. And I suppose he was keeping close to the shore, if these have anything to go by. It wasn't like a major crossing of the sea. Jeremy?
With both these maps, you can see the bravery and the courage that they had to go back to Lystra and Iconium.
Yeah.
On the first journey, presumably not very long after his life had been.
Yeah.
And their heart as well, because when people are just immoral and unpleasant, I don't really want to go and share the gospel with them. But if they try to kill me, I'd be even less.
Yeah.
I'd be even less inclined to be, want to give myself.
Indeed.
To the mission.
Yeah, there might only have been 5-ish years between these visits. It's not as though he's sort of, I hope they've all died or moved on or something. He would be meeting perhaps the same people, the same opposition anyway.
Particularly on the first journey back from Derby.
Yeah.
And the other thought I had was that Barnabas and Mark, I think in the back of my mind, Barnabas has got a connection with Cyprus. He used to have land there. Is that right?
I can't remember that, but you might be right. I don't know if anybody else has any details on that. I mean, the usual points made here is, even the big apostles had an argument and split up, you know. So, and it's very interesting to think, obviously it was a proper argument, but it was over John Mark, over someone else. But basically, you assume Paul was, harsher on all this, saying, I don't want him again, can't trust him. And Barnabas, who we know is the great encourager, probably got alongside John Mark and said, look, I know you messed up or whatever you did. I'll give you a second chance, even if Paul won't. We might want to know more details as what actually happened and all that, but I think we can try and read it between the lines a little bit, perhaps, and get something out of it. Any other comments on the second journey? Okay, on to number three. I think that's the shorter version of it again. Let me just check I've got mine. There we go. Is that? No. What am I doing there? Which one's that? I've gone the wrong way, I think, haven't I? I have. There's the third journey. Right. So what years are we talking about here then? I don't think I told you that the second journey, it starts in Acts 15:36, but goes all the way to chapter 18, verse 22. But the third journey starts straight away in Acts 18:23. What I can tell, in other words, I think it just says, after spending some time in Antioch, Paul set out again. So he didn't have much of a break in this time. So if the second visit was about AD 50, to 53/54, then the third journey was about the same year, 53-54 to 58. So it's almost at this point, that's all Paul is now going to do. He's a missionary, off he goes. And this picks up then from Acts 18:23 to 21:16. Now, this time he seems to travel alone, though obviously Luke goes with him. And when I say he travels alone, he's not alone all the time, but there's no mention that he sets off with Silas, for instance, but he does seem to have companions along the way. And there is a mention of Timothy if you look at chapter 20 and verse 4 onwards, he says he was accompanied by, and there's a list of some of these minor characters we might think, and then it says Timothy also. So it's not like Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Silas, it's Paul and a collection of people. How many of them went all the way or just did different bits, we don't know, but Timothy was involved there, certainly. So he sets off from Antioch again, of course he does, goes to all the usual places, strengthening them again. I don't think there's much mentioned about them this time. And this time he goes to Ephesus on the way there, and he stays about there 2 years. And have I missed out other places? I'm trying to see where. This is on the other map. Let me just double check and know what I'm talking about here. No, that's not. This is the big one. Right, okay, on this map, you can see, as you go through here, there's Laodicea, Hierapolis. I think there's Colossae somewhere. Where's that gone? Oh, it's here. Yeah. It's right. It's all right next to it. I can't get my cursor to work properly. It's all here somewhere. Okay. So this time on the way through to Ephesus, he calls in at these places. And when he gets to Ephesus, he stays there about 2 years. So that's the second journey. Get it right around. So they're not shown on this particular map, but they were around here. Stays in Ephesus about 2 years, goes on to Smyrna, Pergamon, Troas again. Troas this time is where he raises Eutychus, who falls asleep, falls out the window. This time he all seems to know he's got to go on across the sea to Macedonia. Doesn't have a vision this time. On through all those other places. I think he goes to Athens, but certainly it's Corinth. And then he goes back over land to not all the way, obviously. He has to sail part of the way. Where is it on that map? Assos and Mytilene and Miletus. And it's at Miletus that he says farewell to the Ephesian elders. In other words, he hasn't gone back to Ephesus, so he's gone and done all that, goes back sort of overland, sort of sailing on from here, goes back to these places, and when he gets to Miletus, the closest he's going to get to Ephesus, he calls for them to come to him, and there's the big tearful farewell, we'll never see you again, and all the rest of it. And then he sets sail from there through Rhodes and this place, Patera. And this time he doesn't sail back to Antioch, he sails back to Tyre and then eventually down the coast to Caesarea and back to Jerusalem. With gifts, that's when we learn, as we read in Acts 21. Now, whether that's the initial gifts for the famine or whether it's another collection of gifts, that's where I was left wondering. I don't think it's made all that clear. Gary, what have we got on that journey?
While he was at Ephesus for that long stay, he writes to the first letter to the Corinthians.
Yeah.
And then while he's still in, when he moves on to Macedonia, crosses the sea and goes to Macedonia, he writes the second Corinthians. And then when he arrives down in Corinth, he writes the letter to the Romans.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I know we're a long, long time back, we looked at the Corinthian correspondence and I pointed out that those two letters are two out of four letters and we don't have the other two. But you can tell by reading those that there was more correspondence going on. And what we call First Corinthians was probably the second letter. In other words, he's already written to them before, because I think he says, I remind you of this, or I'm telling you it again or something. And then the second letter to Corinthians was the fourth one of them. So, as I say, he was doing lots of other letters. And in fact, it mentions in one of the letters, probably Colossians, that he actually wrote to Laodicea. And we don't have that letter. So he mentions other letters in some of the letters that we do have and so on. Any other thoughts on that third journey? Because there's one other journey, which is not usually regarded as a missionary journey, but it's part of what's happening. Alison?
There's stuff in here about him going to the synagogues and then the Jews not listening.
Yeah.
And move on to the Gentiles. And I'm reflecting that it's a pity that Martin Luther didn't study this a little bit more carefully.
Yes. Point. Jim?
I think the thing that stuns me as I've been reading through these chapters and this chart is how amazing it was, and obviously it's to do with the Holy Spirit, that he should write a letter like the Romans,
yeah,
which is, as we know, you know, massively doctrinal.
Yeah.
How he should write that in those circumstances is just amazing.
Yeah, yes. And he was writing to a place that he hadn't yet visited. I think he keeps saying, I want to visit you and so on, but I've got these other things to do. Of course, he does eventually visit Rome, but in chains. He writes this, which is the longest ever letter that's been found from the ancient world. You just don't normally write that sort of length of letter. Perhaps he had to write that length because he hadn't visited them. It is massively doctrinal. And then, of course, you get the great chapters of 9, 10, and 11 dealing with the Jew-Gentile issue in Rome, and more and more stuff that follows, practical stuff after that, and then he greets lots of people and so on. So, yeah, it's an astonishing... sometimes, well, I'm not sensible this perhaps, but you think about someone producing an oeuvre, you know, a sort of corpus of works, and if you think of Paul's letters like this, this is the big one that sort of sits at the heart of it all. And it's only in our Bibles after Acts because it's the longest, you know, it's not put in there any chronological or doctrinal purposes in order. But to me, this is almost like the jewel in the crown sort of thing. It's wonderful. And I know some preachers spent years and years going verse by verse through it, didn't they? You might know what I'm talking about. So then he does, that's the third one again. He then does journey to Rome because he appeals to Caesar, doesn't he? He says, okay, you've arrested me, but I'm a Roman citizen. I think he's probably using that in order to say, well, this is one way I can get to Rome now, as well as perhaps buying himself a bit of time. And, you know, so he goes before people like Felix and Festus and people like that. And eventually journeys to Rome. And I suppose the most interesting thing about this is the shipwreck that occurs. Anyway, he was arrested in Jerusalem. So you read about this journey from Acts 21 onwards. It follows straight on from the end of the third journey and takes us right to the end of the book of Acts. It occupies a couple of years or more, from about AD 59 to 61. He's held in prison in Caesarea, that's Caesarea Maritima, for a couple of years while he appeals to Rome. So they send him off and they go to this place here. And I think the only reason they stop there is because they have to change ships or they run out of supplies. So it says here they change to a larger grain ship for the rest of the journey. And then they set off to Crete and a place, let's see if the other maps mentions it. Yeah, here it is. So that's where they change ships. That sort of sail around there to Fair Havens, where I think they... put in for a while, and then set off towards Malta, and that's where there's the shipwreck. And the ship is lost in a storm. This map puts it somewhere here, but I don't know, you can possibly tell. I don't think really is referring to that. But the ship smashes into a reef, and everybody has to swim to shore. They swim to Malta. I suppose they perhaps weren't intending to call in at Malta. That wasn't the plan of the ship in the first place. It was probably to go onto their Syracuse. But anyway, the ship's lost, they swim to Malta, and then they go on this little journey, including the Appian Way, the three taverns, where they're suitably refreshed, no doubt, and eventually end up in Rome. And that's where we leave them, or leave Paul. So that's not the way. And Paul spends 2 years preaching the gospel while he awaits his appeal to Nero. So it looks like even like him today, the justice system didn't work particularly quickly, did it? But it gave Paul plenty of chances to preach the gospel and do what God wanted him to do there. Gary, anything on that?
There's just a listing along the way of the letters that Paul wrote while under house arrest.
Yeah.
When he wrote 1 Timothy, and then, that's it, really.
So when he's in prison in Rome, he wrote to Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, and Philippians. Those are known generally as the prison epistles. It's amazing some of the things he writes there about how rejoicing and how wonderful everything is. Well, it obviously can't be. But he was released from prison. It's not in Acts. It happens just after that, about AD 64. Eventually after that, he writes to Timothy and Titus and Timothy again before he's imprisoned in Rome a second time. And at that point, he's not going to get out. And I've got here that he was martyred in AD 67, 68. And I suppose by then, I wonder how old he is. I suppose he certainly would be approaching 60, if not in his 60s by then. If we agree with the other chronology about when he was converted, which was about AD 35, and I suppose it might have been 20-ish, but he was already well up to be able to go and with the letters to Damascus and do what God wanted. So he's had a good 30-something years from his conversion to his death. So he will have been 50s, late 50s, maybe early 60s. And we don't tend to think of some of these people as getting older and becoming old and so on, but they did, like all of us. And God used him over all that span of time. So there we are. Anything more on that from Gary or anybody else?
No, that's about it.
Good. So as I say, I think I've covered, go on with Acts for ages because there's so much good stuff in there, obviously. And as I said at the beginning, it's such a pivotal book. Take it out of your Bible and the New Testament falls apart. You cannot connect the Gospels with the letters. But again, another point I remember making earlier is that if you're wondering why some of this stuff, the miracles and all the power stuff, doesn't happen today, I wonder if it's because we haven't connected properly with the Gospels. We haven't really taken on board everything that Jesus taught in the first place. We haven't been through a proper discipleship sort of thing, whether it's like Peter did or whether it's like Paul eventually did. And perhaps it's because we're not prepared to suffer in the same way. It's all very easy to think, oh yeah, let's just have another Acts in our time. Let's repeat it all. But hang on, are we really prepared for it? And have we actually gone through all the discipline of the disciples and ready to do what God wants in all that? Anyone want any final comments on the book of Acts? Anything? I mean, if you still want to read through it and you want to make, comments or thoughts on it at some point in the future, that's fine. If you want to know what we're going to do next, well, as you know me, I may not be about to tell you. I've got some ideas. And definitely what I'm going to do next time, I'm not going to tell you exactly what it is, but we're going to look at something very mysterious, not a sort of Bible study as such. We're going to look at something else which fascinates me, and it will have implications for how we read parts of the Bible and how we think about God. I doubt if it will take the whole evening, unless one is it's so mysterious that you ask me to say it about six times. Or it just sparks off so much discussion. But we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I do have an Old Testament book in mind for us to read through that I would introduce. So maybe next time I might do that for the last bit and then set you going on that. Or there's a couple of other topics which I want to do eventually. But that's as far as my planning has gone at that point. So I think we'll call it a day now, a few minutes early than usual. Let's switch the recording off, if someone is there to do that, please. I think the recording's staying on. Okay. Just bear in mind that whatever you say now might be recorded, and I'm sure it'll be edited out if you say anything too bad. But anyone want to talk about anything else, or just you know, leave if you need to, if you want to, or just add something about anything? Yes, Rose.
I just wanted to add that John got out of a sickbed to say that Acts 4, 36 and 37 talk about the fact that Barnabas was born in Cyprus.
Ah, right. Thank you. So he was listening in his sickbed, was he?
Oh, yeah. He didn't miss a thing.
Oh, jolly good. Jolly good. How wonderful. John and Jan.
Right, sorry, we're on the tablet now because the laptop died. Can I query how old Paul was at his conversion?
Yeah.
In that he was in the Sanhedrin and be married, so wouldn't he have been maybe 30?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, and therefore he made it into his mid to late 60s, yeah. Which was, you know, made him quite old in his time, I guess. But okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it's in the book somewhere. People have researched exactly when he was born and how old he was at various times. I haven't gone into that much detail. Obviously, there's so much written about Paul. You could spend your whole life just reading about that. You're probably getting even more confused as one book tells you something different from another book. But in the end, it's what God's put in his book that counts. So. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
It's the same.
Okay, well, we'll say goodnight then, and feel free to leave, and I'll see you next week for a big mystery, a mind-blowing mystery. All I will say.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Stay well, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paul.
Pleasure. See you. Bye. I know what Steve's doing. He's watching the football. Doesn't got to half time yet, I guess. Right, well, if anyone is out there listening to me, I'm going to leave, and it'll be up to someone else to shut it down. Thank you. Bye.